You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
My dad taught me a lot, including how easy it is to forget to cancel things. So I downloaded Experian, my BFF, big financial friend. Experian could help me cancel my unused subscriptions and lower my bills, saving me hundreds a year. Get started with the Experian app today. Your big financial friend's here to help you save smarter. Results will vary. Not all bills or subscriptions eligible. Savings not guaranteed. $631 a year. Average savings with 1+ negotiations and 1+ cancellations. Paid membership with connected payment account required. See Experian.com for details. Experian.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. It takes me a while. I record so many, I don't even know which ones I'm recording half the time. But this is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. And today's guest, I'm going to say gun expert. They say in order to become an expert at something, you have to have at least 10,000 hours of experience with said thing. Ryan Muckenhern from Vortex Optics. Do you have 10,000 hours worth of experience with guns?
Yeah. I don't know how many hours in a year, but I've been doing guns professionally or adjacent for 2 decades now. So my first real job, I had to ride my bike to work because I was a lad of 15, and I worked at a little gun shop in central Minnesota where I'm from. I was there for about 6.5 years, and then I moved on to a firearms manufacturer. I was there for about 4.5, and I've been with Vortex about a decade.
Okay. Yeah. So I look at that. I am not a gun expert. I don't know if I'm really an expert at anything, but what you've just said there, I'm going to label you expert for today's conversation.
I would say I'm an enthusiast at the least.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Which makes you an expert.
Sure.
Before we get into all this, I haven't talked with you in a while. How did your hunting season go this year?
I would say it was quiet, but actually it was quite busy. The tag gods were not kind to me this year, which is fine. They never are. So I'm learning to kind of curtail my expectations. I drew one out-of-state tag. I drew a pronghorn in Wyoming, which was great. I try to make that an annual trip. And I shot a slammer. I was very pleased with that. I shot a great pronghorn. That's 2 years in a row that I've taken two really, really good bucks. And then everything else, I put my focus on ruffed grouse and spruce grouse. So between Minnesota and Wisconsin. And I always start that season without any, I guess, aspirations or goals or anything because – I mean, you never know. You flush a grouse. They're like the fastest target in North America. They take off and you pray. And about late October, I had really gotten into a good number of birds. And I thought to myself, holy smokes, I have a chance of actually like flushing or observing 100 birds in the field this year, which is, for me, huge. And my final hunt was on the last day of Wisconsin season. And I flushed my 101st bird for 2024. Did not kill 101 birds. That is very difficult. I fancy myself an okay wing shooter. But I achieved better than 15%, which is, I think, good, maybe. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time walking a lot of miles for rough grouse. Hit up Minnesota for spruce grouse and rough grouse as well. Didn't keep a log on how many miles that I walked, but it was a substantial amount.
Right.
Yeah.
Is this with a dog?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. Nope.
Got two size 14 dogs underneath my legs. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Were they barking at the end of the day, all those miles?
It doesn't wear me out too bad. Yeah.
I'm sorry. That was such a dumb joke.
No, it was good. I thought of Kevin from The Office when he said these dogs are barking. I've got a really good boot system that I've been running now for probably 12 seasons. Not the same pair of boots, as in individuals, but, a boot that works really well with my foot and it doesn't beat me up too bad. And it's pretty gentle walking. You know, I've got an Upland vest on, some hydro and some snacks and a pretty lightweight 28 gauge that doesn't burden me too much, but
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And, man, there's something like, there's guys out there. Tony Peterson is one of them. I think if you were going to ask him on certain days, would you rather hunt deer or go pheasant hunting? He'd probably pick some form of wing shooting over deer hunting.
Sure.
Is that one of your favorite things to do?
That's a great question. It's one I've been thinking about a lot in the past couple of years. So before I got into like Western big game hunting, being from Minnesota, we had we didn't really have a great deer population. In fact, I started hunting deer when I was 12. I saw my first whitetail in the field with a rifle when I was 16. So I never got the whitetail bug, really. I killed a bunch of them, and, you know, I love eating them, but I never went out of my way to be somebody who is like a really enthusiastic bow hunter. Like here at Vortex, most of the guys that I chat with bow hunt from opener to end of season, which actually is still going on in parts of the state. And they're fanatical about it. I never got that way. I got big into muzzle loading when I was probably like 16, 17, 18. I really started hitting that pretty hard and did a number on the whitetail population. But I never got nuts about that. What I was, though, at that point in time was an obsessive waterfowler. And, you know, we had like 60 or 65 day seasons. Like my senior year of high school or junior year of high school or my first year of college. And I think between, it was either my junior and senior year or my senior year and freshman year of college, I missed 7 collective days of those 2 waterfowl seasons. And so I used to do that tremendously. Loved hunting field geese, love hunting big water divers. You know, when the air temp is sub 30, water temp's like 33 or you know, at 32, breaking ice with the boats, loved that. I hunted pheasants in South Dakota on an annual trip for a number of years, never got big on roosters. And I think, I don't know if it was just some part of me is like, it's a non-endemic species and they release most of them. And I don't know. I never got crazy about it. Rough grouse were always a fascination of mine. And one, because nothing is as delicious as a rough grouse. Two, they're such a challenging target to hit. And then three, the places that you find them in are like Narnia. Mm-hmm. And I took somewhat of a hiatus from that for a number of years, just busier, you know, came up with other interests, got big into Western big game hunting. And that was a pretty big distraction. And then, would have been a couple years ago when I moved out here, I knew that Wisconsin had really good rough grouse hunting and I dabbled, when I could. And then a few years back, probably like 6, I really poured the coals to it. And now I try to hit every weekend that I can for rough grouse.
Yeah.
And my hunting partner said something fairly impactful to me this year. We were actually in Wyoming. We finished up, pronghorn somewhat early. I tagged out day 1, he tagged out day 3. And we spent the rest of the time chasing Hungarian partridge. Okay. And I had not seen a Hungarian in probably 25 years. And we pushed the same group of probably 50 for the better part of 5 hours. And, you know, did a lot of missing, connected with some birds. We ended up with, a limit and a half between the 2 of us or 3 of us that were chasing them. And he said, you know, hunting mule deer and pronghorn and whitetails and other big game is exciting and riveting, and it is. I mean, it's why I show up for work every morning just to figure out how to shoot mule deer better and you know, with more efficacy and whatnot. But there's not a lot that replaces the feeling of an upland bird breaking cover at your feet. And I think that's true. You know, with glassing large drainages or open, you know, high plains desert or grasslands for muleys, you have a lot of downtime where you're not on, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And you're hoping that you spot an ear flick or an antler or something like this. And to me, that fills my bucket. But when you're chasing, whether you're working with a dog or whether you're like me and you're just out there banging trails, you're always on. You can't be complacent because that bird breaks from cover. And whether it's a you know, ringneck pheasant or a ruff grouse or a Hungarian or whatever, that bird breaks from cover and you have 2, maybe 3 seconds to make a decision, flip the levers, manipulate all the things needed to succeed in this. And it's almost a constant adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
And so much so that I'm 25, I'm kicking off what I call the upland safari, and I'm going to target all the endemic species of upland in the lower 48. And okay. So I think it's going to take me 4 states and I think 3 years. And I'm gonna make a go at it, and I'm gonna get
what,
them all.
What are those birds, so we all know?
Sure. So in the grouse family, there's ruff grouse, spruce grouse, sage grouse, sharp-tailed grouse. There's 2 species of what are called blue grouse. So you have sooties and you have duskies. And then prairie chicken. And then there's mountain quail, valley or California quail, Mierns or Montezuma quail, scaled quail, bobwhite quail, Gamble's quail, and then who am I missing here? I wasn't counting. I think that's everybody. Yeah. So
because pheasant...
Oh, and ptarmigan. White-tailed ptarmigan.
Okay. So yeah. Because pheasant was introduced, they don't fall into that, correct?
Yeah. Not saying that I'm not going to pound a rooster if it flushes, because yeah. I absolutely am. But yeah, so the endemics first. And I just picked the lower 48 because Alaska represents, one, a financial complexity, and two, just a logistics and timing thing.
Yeah.
That's tough.
That's crazy.
There's a couple of ptarmigan species in Alaska that you can only get there, not in the lower 48. So mm-hmm. they're on the future hit list. And then there's some really cool introduced species. Like in Nevada, you can get into what's called a Himalayan snowcock, which is probably the epitome of success for an uplander to go kill one of those things in the United States. One, they're super rare. Two, you hunt them in terrain that's just obscene and you know, really challenging. Yeah. There's chukar partridge, of course, ringneck pheasant, Hungarian partridge, which I got into this year. And then a couple others here and there if you know where to look and what you're looking for. But I figured those endemics, and especially the quail, are gonna keep me plenty busy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So are you adding these into your normal big game routine, or are you going full bore into this mission?
Full bore. Okay. So there's some things like mountain quail, for example. Mountain quail is one that I'm not struggling with, but there's a few places of opportunity to get into them with routine success, maybe. Yeah. And I don't know what I'm doing with them. I've never hunted them before. But I'm having a hard time telling myself, you're going to drive 30 hours to scramble up the side of a mountain to look for a bird. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, how do I make this? I'm going to say worth my while, because that makes it sound like, oh, the hunting is very transactional for me. But Washington State, for instance, I can get into mountain quail. I can also get into Columbia blacktail. And I don't have a Columbia blacktail, and I've always wanted to hunt them. And Mark's from Washington, and he talks about Columbia blacktail hunting very endearingly. And I think that would be a super cool combo hunt. I will say the major focus will be the bird. Mm-hmm. The secondary focus will be the deer. And then, you know, for everything else, like sage grouse, for instance, I don't have a dog. And so I think I'm going to have to work like 10 times harder to make this actually happen. Sage grouse, I think I'm going to take, you know, a slot of time, and it's all I'm going to be doing is looking for sage grouse, to try to find one of those. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good luck, brother. Thanks, I mean, that man. sounds like a major undertaking, especially when you're talking about subspecies in just like niche environments.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so you have to be within, I'm going to guess, 50 miles of where these things live, if not a smaller.
Like on the dot.
Yeah, on the dot. And so that's crazy, man. Good luck. Hopefully that that all works out for you.
Yeah, same.
All right. I got to run through a couple partners here real quick before we get into the meat and potatoes of today's episode. If you're looking for a saddle hunting accessories, go check out Tethered. These guys offer everything that you need if you have any interest in becoming a saddle hunter or just adding a saddle into your tool belt of gear for any type of mobile hunting you want. Wasp Archery, huge fan of this company, huge fan of these people. Love the material, love the design, love the function that goes with this brand. So if you're looking to change your broadhead in 2025, look no further than wasparchery.com. I do have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. And then we got Ryan here. What's your favorite part about working for Vortex Optics?
The people, the customers that I chat with, not to get too long-winded, but when I got into the industry, my thought was that in a short amount of time, I'd be spending my off time in places like Tanzania or New Zealand or, you know, the South Pacific chasing exotic critters. The reality is somebody's got to pick up the phone and somebody's got to write the orders. What I get, though, out of the customers that I talk to globally is I get to live vicariously through them, and I get to help facilitate, you know, their successes and their dreams and their hopes through our product line and through, you know, sound advice and recommendations and things like that. And so I'd have to say that getting to chat with, you know, an innumerable amount of folks on an annual basis and hearing about their wildest adventures coming true. I mean, I do the same thing every single day. I've never grown tired of it. I love it.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I'll second that. Like the whoever is the HR department has got it right for Vortex, right? I mean, whoever is making these hires are just good people, man. I have not met an a-hole at Vortex. Yeah.
Sure.
I have not met one. So that's good. That's a good thing. So obviously, Vortex Optics offers rangefinders, spotting scopes, binoculars, red dots, rifle scopes, apparel, sunglasses. Like these guys have everything you want. VortexOptics.com. Next on the list, Code Blue Sense. These guys have just released what could be my new favorite product that's coming out. And it's just an old product, but now there's two of them in the same package. So it's the Rope-A-Dope Mock Scrape Kit. I'm a huge fan of mock scrapes. Paired that with a trail camera, and it's an awesome way to get inventory of the deer in your area on the farm that you hunt. CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. And then we got Huntworth. These guys are doing great things. I love their solids that these guys have recently introduced. I don't know why. I'm just a huge fan of solid colors, not to mention that they do have a lineup of really good camo if you're into that. I love their heat boost technology that's in their cold weather gear right now, their gloves. I mean, it's the time of year where you need to be picking up some Huntworth. So huntworthgear.com, go check them out. And then we have Reveal trail cameras by Tacticam. The new 3.0 versions are extremely easy to use. You take basically a picture, you scan the QR code, you put batteries in the camera, you download the app, and your camera is ready to go within minutes. Okay. And that's a lot different from the way cell cams used to be, where you had to enter in a whole bunch of numbers and letters and then make sure that there was a card entered in there. All that's taken care of now. So go to tacticam.com/cameras and check out the new 3.0 versions of those cameras. And last but not least, probably the coolest company within all of these is because it's my company, Ryan, and that is Full Sneak Gear. If you're looking for a t-shirt that basically says, I like to hunt, then you need to go check out FullSneakGear.com. Stocking caps, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, whatever you need, we got it. FullSneakGear.com. All right. I'm done whoring out. okay? All right? I've paid the bills, like they say. Ryan, I want to start a gun collection. I think as any real man, we kind of need it. I feel like any outdoorsman needs a good gun collection. So I don't even know where to start. Where do we start if we're looking to start picking up some guns?
That's a bold question. I'd love to tell you there's a definitive, like a pathway one would follow, a map or a recipe. The reality is, and again, I've been at this for a long time, and I've been fascinated with firearms since I could, actually since before I could read. Just it's something about them, innately interesting things they are, their history, how they came to be. I think they define us as a species, which might be a contested standpoint, but for as long as we have been upright, walking, and communicating, we've been trying to figure out ways to harvest game or protect ourselves. And the natural progression was the firearm, and here we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the beginning, when I started, quote, my collection, if you will, it was very random. It was just things that I found interesting or thought were cool. And then you'd fall into a niche or a groove in that, like, the individual history of a singular firearm or even a company or a country that utilized this firearm in wartime or whatever, you name whatever historical significance it has, you want to gather them all. Or you develop a brand preference and you do that. I think, though, if I could go back in time and tell the 14, 15-year-old version of myself when I was starting to kind of really get serious about putting my money into this kind of thing, is collect with purpose first. Because you'll save a lot of time. And if you're not cash rich, you'll probably save a lot of money.
Right.
And, you know, so you pose an interesting question, like as an outdoorsman, and we'll make that statement for like the hunter shooter, right?
Okay.
What you should mirror your interests and the things that you either are already doing or foresee yourself doing. And I think one of the first ones on that list is a darn good shotgun. And I think about how many rifles I own and how many different calibers I hand load for. I'm like, I'm fascinated by rifles. They're very interesting. But in comparison, a shotgun is so much more utilitarian. And there are so many, I think, more fantastic things that you can do with one. I mean, you can shoot birds out of the air with it. I mean, how neat is that? A good shotgun goes a long ways for many, many different things. You being in the state that you're in, it's going to fill the void or the role of your rifle too, because you could shoot straight walls, right? Mm-hmm. So you could shoot a 450 or 350 or something along those lines, but you could also do the same thing with pretty much the same degree of success with a good shotgun and a good slug barrel or a good slug load. Mm-hmm. So I would tell most people, if you're starting out on an adventure like this, the shotgun is going to give you the most opportunity as a sportsman or woman. Because there's seasons that start usually around the 1st of September, where you can get into morning doves. And then we fall into waterfowl for like early goose or teal seasons. And then we get into upland game like pheasants, like grouse, like partridge, things like this. And then you can double duty for deer. And then you get into like upland small game like rabbits or squirrels. A shotgun is perfect for that. Mm-hmm. So once you find one, you'll soon realize that maybe you don't want a 12 gauge for hunting bunnies. Maybe you want a 28 or a 20. So then you get a second one. And then you think to yourself, you know, it would be really slick for hunting squirrels is a 410. Mm-hmm. And then you get your third. Mm-hmm. And then you think to yourself, instead of having one barrel, I want two. So then you get your first over under and then your first double. And then it cascades. And that's how you round out the shotgun portion of your collection.
Yeah. How do you know where to start? So like for me, I started with a 20 gauge and I really never left a 20 gauge for turkey hunting, knowing that if I wanted to be a badass, I could pick up a 12 gauge and I could do the same thing with a 12 gauge. How do you know, especially with shotguns, where you are in all of those options?
That's tough. And especially if you're brand new to it and you've never done it before. I used to be a coach for my high school's trap team. And I had students of all shapes and sizes. I had guys, gals, I had jocks, I had nerds, everybody in between. And when we would go out and we'd be in practice sessions and we'd be shooting, one thing to be super cognizant of is gun fit and recoil. And I remember one young lady who ended up being just a stellar shooter. Her dad was a customer of mine at the gun shop, had gotten her a 12 gauge for doing this. And she was little. She was 5 foot nothing and maybe 100 pounds. And she was trying to horse this 12 gauge around. And it was honestly, it was kicking the crap out of her. Mm-hmm. And she was having a very, very challenging time being successful with it. And I think a lot of it was she didn't have confidence in herself because of the gun and how the gun had kind of beat her up a little bit. And so I brought out a smaller framed 20 gauge and I said, let's just give this a crack and let's see if it works for you. So the gun was probably a pound and a quarter lighter. The gun had, here again, maybe half as much recoil in comparison. And immediately she was picking up birds that otherwise she was dropping. She went from probably being a 25 to 30% shooter up to probably a 65 to 70% shooter. She had the fundamentals, like she knew, you know, gun up, you know, swing, follow through, et cetera. But the point of detonation when she pulled the trigger, I think she was wincing pretty hard. And once she felt that gun wasn't beating her up or she wasn't having to work twice as hard to run it, mm-hmm. all of a sudden she started smoking birds. And so if you've never done it before and you're like, I am in the market for a shotgun, you're going to have a lot of social influence out there that says, you know, 12 gauge is the utilitarian gauge. And that is true. You know, there's nothing that you really can't do with a 12 gauge. You can hunt the biggest of waterfowl if you're hunting swans or if you're hunting Canada geese. You know, it's a perfect thing for that. And you can certainly shoot a quail or a partridge or a rough grouse with a 12 gauge as well. But if you haven't done it, it's worth going to, one, find somebody who has. Find somebody who you're comfortable with, who you've got a good rapport with, who you're not afraid to kind of put it all out on the table and say, look, I've never walked this walk before. I don't know what I don't know. Show me. And if they have a couple of gauges, a 12, a 20, if they have a couple of styles, whether that's a pump, a break action of any kind, whether it's single, superposed, so an over-under or a double barrel, or if they have a semi-auto, go out and feel them. And talk to somebody who has some clout in the wing shooting space, because, you know, we take for granted, we go to the gun shop or the gun store and you pick brand A, B, or C off the rack and it's a gun, it's got a stock, it's got a trigger, it's got a fore end and a barrel. You put it up to your shoulder. That does not mean that gun fits you. So if you can talk to somebody who understands what that statement means, what gun fit is, and can show you the ropes on it a little bit, your eyes will be opened tremendously to what a gun that doesn't fit will do to you and what a gun that does fit will do for you. Mm-hmm. So network with some folks that have been down that road before and go out and give it a try. Yep. You know, if you think about this, like you shoot archery, how important it is for a bow to be set up for you as a shooter.
Right.
Paramount. Right. You and I are not dissimilar in size and build. I promise you that your index points, your peep position, if you run a kisser button or a nose button, it's going to be different than mine. Mm-hmm. My draw length is going to be different. How I grip my bow is going to be different. All of these things are going to go into what makes your system successful for you and what makes mine successful for me. And they're not likely interchangeable.
Right.
Not until you get a ton of repetitions, a lot of experience, mm-hmm. where you can go out and do it. But if you're shopping shotguns, I think first and foremost, find somebody who knows what gun fit is. Try them on. You'll know when you feel one that fits right. If that person can describe to you what proper form and fit is, it'll be like turning a light bulb on. Like, oh, that's what it meant.
Okay.
And then go out and shoot some clays. And get a feel for how do you manage.
This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack Fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
Recoil. What do you like in a recoil impulse if you're shopping semi-automatic? So you'll have like an inertia system versus a gas-operated system. And occasionally you'll have a shooter that there's a very clear delineation in preference. Like, no, I hate the way an inertia gun feels, or I hate the way a gas system feels. And get a little time behind it. The good news is pick an arms manufacturer these days that's been around for more than 20 years. The chances you're going to run into a really good example, and whether that's Mossberg on the budget end or Benelli on the high end and everything in between, you're going to get a good product. Mm-hmm. It's just the right product for you.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's just say here, I'm going to buy that utilitarian shotgun. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, you know, let's just say it's going to be a Mossberg pump, or it's a Mossberg semi-auto, whatever the case is. I got it. How then do I manage how I feel, like, and what animal I'm hunting, and what shell to use is
sure
what I'm getting at. Like, they got 3-inch, they got 3.25, and so on. Yep. How do I pick that?
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Your little one grew 3 inches overnight. Adorable. Also, expensive. Sell their pint-sized pieces on Depop and list them in minutes with no selling fees. Because somewhere, a dad refuses to pay full price for the clothes his kids will outgrow tomorrow. And he's ready to buy your son's entire wardrobe right now. Consider your future growth spurt budget secured. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
Sure. So here again, there'd be a lot of social influence. When I started waterfowling, which would have been about the age of, I think seriously waterfowling, probably 8 years old, where I was trying to get out as much as my dad could get me out, or as much as my grandpa could get me out. 3.5-inch 12 gauge had only been out for about 9 years. So late 80s is when that came out. Mossberg was the first outfit to bring that out in their 835 Ultimag. It was an unwritten rule that the only way you could kill geese with steel shot was a 3.5-inch 12 gauge. Came to pass that wasn't necessarily true. We were a bit handcuffed by pellet technology. So the steel shot of yesteryear was poor at best. Mm-hmm. And the only way you could find success with it a lot of times, unless you were a real ace wing shooter, was to stuff more pellets in there. So I'll speak to this specifically from the waterfowl standpoint first and foremost. You know, you're going to be restricted to a non-toxic shot of some kind, whether that's steel, bismuth, tungsten, you know, other, you know, non-lead metals. So you've got a huge palette to select from there. 3.5-inch, I'm not saying is dead, because it's not. There are still guns that are produced in 3.5-inch every single day, but it is waning in popularity. And a 3-inch 12 gauge shell, and this is just a self-proclaimed expert making the statement, a 3-inch 12 gauge shell with the right payload, the right pellet, and the right shot size will kill any winged critter that you want within shotgun distances, and especially with the shot type. There's a new shot that I think was really, really popularized with turkey hunters called Tungsten Super Shot. You may have heard of it. It does things that it shouldn't do for its shot size. So those rules are kind of being broken right now. But I know waterfowlers that are killing decoying geese with 5s and 6s and 7s. Whereas before it was triple B, 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 1, maybe 2 shot. So that scale is sliding right now. But I digress. A 3-inch 12 gauge is about all you'd need for anything that would fly. Gotcha. Shot sizes are species dependent. If you're going to be shooting steel and you're looking at larger geese or larger waterfowl, you know, a two is a good play as your minimum shot size. Going above a B or a BB, I think, might give us a little bit of diminishing returns, because now our pellet diameter is so large that we lose penetrative capability, despite having mass. So, you know, in there, upland species, again, if we're looking at steel shot, fives or fours, threes would be pretty large. And then like small upland species, let's say rough grouse, for instance, if you have to shoot steel, if you're hunting in like a waterfowl production area that happens to have rough grouse, or you're hunting a piece of ground that mandates that you use anything but lead in the steel pallet, sevens or sixes are going to be kind of all you have. And then things like rabbits and squirrels that will also do double duty. Once you get into the non-toxic varieties, again, it gets a little more confusing because it's somewhat new territory, but usually you can step down probably three, if not four shot sizes and still be successful with that. So if you shoot tungsten, for instance, it's pretty expensive to shoot ducks with tungsten. Here again, I wouldn't tell you to start there because if you're not a crack wing shot, you're going to be burning a lot of holes in the sky. But I've got very dear friends of mine that are hunting sea ducks, like the largest of ducks, and they're shooting nines, eights, sevens, tungsten, and they're crushing birds at 40, 50, 60 yards.
Okay.
So a little bit of study on that one, but 3-inch 12 gauge, great place to start.
Gotcha.
Again, utilitarian.
And that then, so we're talking about waterfowl here, mm-hmm. right? Now we're talking about big game in your typical deer hunt,
yep.
With a shotgun.
Yep.
3-inch shell would work there as well. Do
yep.
we need to have a gun? Do we need to change barrels out?
You
is
may.
That a thing? Do
yeah.
we need to, are there shotguns out there where I can go hunt deer in the afternoon, not change a barrel, and then go hunt waterfowl in the mornings?
Short answer is absolutely. And it wasn't until probably the mid 2000s when I had a little bit more pocket money to monkey with this. But the first shotguns that I would have been hunting deer with were exactly what you just described. They were my duck guns. They were my pheasant guns. And they would use a load called a Foster-type slug. You'll hear them referred to as a rifled slug. They don't actually spin the bullet. That's a common misconception. But they are made to be fired through smooth bores. And you can then take that a step further if you wanted to really kind of wring out some performance in this. And that many shotguns, modern shotguns, have the ability to change a choke tube. So just like we would use an extra full or a turkey diameter constriction tube for our turkey seasons, you can get a choke tube that gives you a wide open pattern like cylinder or skeet. You can also get what's called a rifled choke tube. So think of it like a 3 or 4 inch section of your barrel is now rifled, just like your rifle would be.
Mm-hmm.
If you shoot a rifled choke tube and you shoot those very inexpensive rifled style slugs, often you're going to experience accuracy that you just didn't think was possible out of those old pumpkin ball slugs.
Okay.
They can shoot like a house of fire. In fact, I've got an 870 that I bought years ago, and with the sole purpose of having it as a drive gun, short barrel, magazine tube extension, light, handy, fast. And I have a red dot mounted on it, and I have a rifled choke tube in it so that I can shoot the inexpensive slugs. But it shoots almost as good as some of my dedicated slug guns. Almost, not quite, but mm-hmm. almost. Appreciable accuracy at 100 yards, no doubt about it. Not this, pie plate level accuracy. I'm talking like very respectable groupings.
Mm-hmm.
And so a simple choke tube change, you don't have to change your barrel. You just have to carry with you an extra choke tube, thread it out. Put your bird choke back in once you've done your deer drives for the morning, or you've done your stand sit, and you know what? I want to go jump shoot that pond and take a couple mallards home, put your modified in, and go to town.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
That's good to know. That's like a cost thing as well. So.
Oh, yeah.
There's a question that I'm going to be asking you. It's the same question for every group of firearms that we yeah. talk about, because you talked about Mossberg, you talked about Benelli, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the price range in between those.
Yep.
Can you get the same thing out of a Mossberg that you can out of a Benelli? And I'm not talking about the brand specifically, but the cost is what I'm getting at here.
So do you mean, are you getting the same result
Does basically, if I have the money, am I getting a better outcome because I'm buying a Benelli than I am buying a Mossberg or those, I don't know, affordable brands versus the really expensive brands?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think as like in a consumer market, it's very easy to get sucked into the thought that you need to spend money to be successful.
Yes.
Okay. And so if you're shopping shotguns, and this is a great example, Mossberg 500 has been around forever. And they really have remained unchanged. They've added accoutrement to them that have modernized them, but the mechanisms themselves have not been altered. You know, it's the same heart and soul of the action. Everything remains the same. The touch points have improved, perhaps. So like the engine in that vehicle is still the same as it has been since day one. And that's the important part, right? That's the part that functions the gun and that allows us to get that second, third shot off. Could you be as successful with a $399 shotgun as you could be with a $1,599 shotgun? The short answer is absolutely. I'm reminded of an old friend of mine, Tom Knapp, was a trick shooter who shot for Benelli. He shot for CZ. And I think Tommy sold a lot of Benellis to a lot of people because he was really, really good with them. Mm-hmm. The reality is I could have given Tom a single shot H&R with a hammer, and he could have thrown 9 clays up in the air, and knowing Tommy, he could have probably pulled 2 or 3 out of the air with a single shot because he was just that good of a wing shooter. And so with the right amount of practice, you can get the same, I mean, you get analogous performance, right? The cost of the gun does not ensure success. Actually, another great example, when I was a coach, I had a young shooter on my team who was very poor. His folks shared a car. They just did not come from a lot of money. They shared a car, and he did everything he could to be as competitive as he could. And he had a gun that his dad had bought from the gun shop that I worked at for $79. And it was a Stevens pump and no vent rib, just a simple bead barrel, fixed choke. Once he understood the discipline itself and understood what leads were and understood, you know, what was his max effective range that he could engage a clay bird, he started cleaning birds left and right. And I would say of the 50-ish kids that we had on the team, he was probably in the top 5. And he was doing it with an $80 gun. Yeah. If I would have put, a $13,000 Perazzi in his hands, I think he would have been better. But that's because the gun would have fit him more. And then he would have had the ability to change choke tubes and not just be shooting this modified tube, which he did actually really good with anyway. Yeah. So with discipline and with practice, you don't necessarily afford yourself a higher degree of success with a more expensive shotgun.
Gotcha.
There are things about it that I think are worth noting, and especially in like semi-automatics. So, and I'll pick on the Benelli operating system because I do have a bias to it. If you look at like an M2 or Super Black Eagle 3, or even for that matter, an M1 or a Super Black Eagle 2 or an original Super Black Eagle, the mechanism itself is as perfect as I think exists. And this comes from shooting gas guns for a lot of years and shooting inertia guns from a lot of years. And my strong preference is to the inertia design that Benelli employs. If I was to compare it to, say, and I'll pivot a little bit and say like a Remington 1100, I'm ending up with immediately a lighter weight gun with smaller dimensions, which most times ends up being more nimble and graceful in the hand. And then also the reliability of the system, specifically the Benelli, is astronomically better. The Remingtons had a notorious reputation for getting gummy and sooty, and then they had what they call a friction ring that basically is an O-ring that would degrade over, any 100 rounds or 1,000 rounds. It just kind of depended on the gun and its tolerances. And that gun would stop you dead in its tracks if its friction ring died. The Benelli, on the other hand, they poured their heart and soul into the engineering of that system. And because of it, extraordinary reliability, very lively gun in the hand, which I think is conducive to wing shooting success. And I would say, like, you're getting what you pay for when you buy a Benelli. It costs a lot. I've seen a lot of inertia guns come out in my time and space. None of them have been able to take a bite out of what Benelli is doing. They are expensive. If you're seeking a premier auto, and things like liveliness in the hand, pointability, recoil, and reliability are high on your list of attributes that you want out of that system, it'd be a hard bargain to beat it, right? So yeah. They are costly.
Yeah.
Bear in mind.
That's everything in this world, right? Like price in some way, shape, or form. If your product is the best, it's going to reflect quality.
Sure.
In some way, shape, or form. Okay. I think we got what we needed out of the shotgun. All right. That's the one-stop shop for outdoorsmen.
Yeah.
What's the next gun in our collection that we should be picking up?
So probably a rifle, right? And this is always, or could be, a more challenging conversation. So you're a resident of Iowa, and your rifle hunting is extremely limited. You can hunt with a straight wall, or actually you can hunt with a 35 caliber cartridge of X length, which is kind of interesting because you can shoot a 35 Whalen if you wanted to, which is really neat. You should do that, by the way.
Is that a lever action rifle?
You can get it in a bolt gun.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually put a Tika together for a coworker of mine in 35 Whalen. And like, that's a God's honest 400 or 500 yard deer gun, if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So you could do that, but I would have to audit your aspirations. Like, do you have a desire to start hunting mule deer or pronghorn or elk, in other states with a rifle? And at that point, we're going to be looking at, you know, larger format, big game cartridges like 308, 30-06, 270, 300 Winchester short Magnum, 300 Winchester Magnum, 6.5 Creedmoor, things like this. There's a lot of really good rifles on the market. That's an even murkier space to be, because the delta of cost is so significant. Like, you can go buy a Savage Axis right now for probably $299 to $349. The likelihood is that gun is going to shoot like unbelievable. Ruger Americans are another great example of a very budget-minded rifle that shoot like a match gun, where you don't have to spend a ton of money. Tika is one that I pick on a lot, because I think they're about as perfect as you can get, and you're under $800 for a rifle. Or conversely, you can go to Weatherby and you can pick up a Mark V for $2,000. You can go to Gunworks and you can get a build done for $8,000. The question is what does it get you? If we look at a rifle, like what makes one great? And it's really, it's barrel. Is it a good barrel? Is it a quality barrel? Its receiver, its action, does it feed rounds? Does it eject rounds? Does it have a nice cycle to the bolt? And its trigger, is it light and crisp and dependable? The stock, you'll find people of varying, temperature on how important stock is. I think I'm going to draw an analogy back to archery. I think your rifle stock fit is extremely critical. Some people are far more tolerant of it. I'm a bit anal retentive about rifle stock fit. So an example of a rifle, like a Bergara B14 HMR Pro, you have two axes of adjustment. You've got your comb height and you've got your length of pull on that rifle stock. Fitting that gun to you is fantastic. The barrel, great barrel. The receiver, great receiver. The trigger, great trigger. I think you can get away with not a lot in a rifle. In fact, I know a lot of guys here that do that. You know, they're mostly bow guys and they just needed a good rifle. So they picked a reliable cartridge that they could find any place they went hunting of adequate power. And they purchased a rifle that fit their budget. Most of them shoot really darn good. I think if you get deep into rifles, you're going to find a preference to a fit and a feel. Again, most of them all seem to shoot pretty darn good these days, but fit and feel is where you start separating yourself from, you know, the regular fodder on your gun shop shelf and just seeing a bunch of guns. Now we're getting into a very specific system. For me in production rifles, that's really been Tika. I've been running them now since 2005. And I've owned a great number of them. I still do own a great number of them. I recommend them probably daily. They really are just a sweetheart of a gun. Mm-hmm. And again, I mentioned earlier, Ruger's American. I lost money on that bet. If you'd have told me that they would have produced a sub $600 rifle that would outperform some of my custom shop builds, they sure did. And we see a lot of those come through the shop every single year, and they're hunting here in Wisconsin, or they're going on a once in a lifetime moose hunt in Alaska. They just plain work.
I want to back up just a second.
Yeah.
And we started diving into the quality, mm-hmm. which is important, but how do we, like, you started this conversation off with cartridge and what game we planned on hunting.
Yeah.
So unlike a shotgun, we can get the 12 gauge and then we can determine what animal we want to hunt based off of the shell.
Yeah.
Here, it sounds like we need to almost reverse that and pick a cartridge aimed towards the animal that we plan on hunting and then choose the rifle based off of the cartridge.
Yeah. If you told me that all you want a rifle for is calling coyotes, mm-hmm. I'm not going to recommend a 300 Winchester Magnum for you. I think that's way too much gun. I think that you'll not love your time with it. You know, if it was predators, just to use them as an example, I'm going to be telling you, hey, a 223, 22 250, 6 arc, a 243, all these will be appropriate selections for you. For calling coyotes or hunting fox or bobcat, whatever it is that you're chasing. You don't need a big giant, anchor and elk, big game cartridge to do that. You need something that's maneuverable, low recoil, fast. And if you're a hide hunter, if you don't want to blow them to pieces, you need something that you have an available bullet that is appropriate for that kind of target, but two, is not going to decimate them when you hit it. And you'll find that in your small caliber centerfire rounds, 223, probably the most common example. Conversely, deer, pronghorn, mule deer, whitetail, coos deer, something in that 243 is a minimum, up to 300 Win Mag is a great choice. And then if you're like me and you're the opportunistic hunter and you hope that the tag gods grant you passage anywhere you might apply, you might focus kind of on the higher end of the cartridge scale so that you're covered down. So if I pull an elk tag in Wyoming, I have a 300 Winchester Magnum that is handily going to do the job. I'm not overgunned with a 300 Winchester Magnum shooting pronghorn. At that point in time, it really just becomes bullet selection. Mm-hmm. I don't want a fast, frangible varmint-type bullet for shooting big game. And conversely, I don't want a solid for shooting big game. Most states, actually, that's illegal. I want a bullet that works reliably, that isn't going to destroy the thing that I'm hoping to take home and eat. The caliber at the larger end of target spectrum, once we start getting into 100-pound or greater target, is not as critical, as long as you have an appropriate amount. And so I don't think you can be overgunned, necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think you can be undergunned. But I don't think you can be overgunned. I've taken pronghorn with 300 Weatherby, which for many years was the king of the hill for 30 caliber offerings on the market. With the right bullet and the right placement, I still had meat to bring home. And it was more than adequate for that. Certainly would have been fine for elk, too.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So is there a rifle or a cartridge that can be for the predator hunter and the guy who takes the once in a lifetime elk hunt or moose hunt? I mean, is there a gun that covers all of that, or does that just kind of come down to how far you are away from your target?
I think there can be, and we'll bounce back to shotguns here for a second. Used to be, I'd have moms and dads and aunts and uncles and grandmas and grandpas bring in youngsters into the shop before the youth waterfowl seasons would start. And, they'd have this 7, 8, 9-year-old kid that was very green. And that parent or guardian wanted the opportunity to get them into wing shooting, but didn't want them to be subjugated to a tremendous amount of recoil or firearms heft. And often they'd look at a 410. And a gauge like 410 has often been quoted as a youth or child's gauge. And I think it's actually backwards logic. Because you're marginalizing the performance of that cartridge so much that if you give it to somebody who's already marginal in experience, it's like doubling down the failure rate, right? And so you, another parallel would be like archery. So we have these phenomenal bows these days. I mean, I can shoot my bow at 100 yards and experience outstanding accuracy out of it. You know, if I put up a playing card there, I might be able to hit it with my bow. I can't do that with a 35-pound recurve. I can pull that recurve back all day long because it's only 35 pounds, but I've marginalized the equipment so much that I really, really have to be good with it. And I don't have sights and I don't have a release. I'm using my fingers. And when you're looking at rifle cartridges, think along those lines too. Like, yeah, you could go kill a polar bear with a 35-pound recurve. Is that the best thing to do? Or you could go hunt ducks and geese with a 410 as long as you had the right payload. But you're talking about, you know, maybe a 3/4 ounce shot charge compared to an ounce and 5/8 in a 12 gauge. You have so few opportunities to hit that bird just on pellet count alone. And then you have such a marginal pattern in the first place. Like it's challenging. With a rifle cartridge, I do feel the same way. Like 6.5 Creedmoor is a great example of a cartridge that kind of does a lot of things really good. Not perfect, but really good. In that, if you and I were going out coyote hunting and you said, "Hey Ryan, work me up a load that won't blow holes in the coyote," all I have is a 6.5 Creedmoor. That's an easy thing to do. I can do that in an evening. You know, we can come up with a load that your rifle shoots really well. It'll be fast, it'll be flat shooting, and it won't do a number on the hides. And then you can say, "Hey, let's go elk hunting. I want a load for my 6.5 Creedmoor that'll kill an elk." And I'm going to pick something like a 127 grain Barnes LRX or a Nosler Accubond or a Terminal Ascent from Federal. And I've got all the confidence in the world that you can kill that elk. But when you go to these lighter cartridges that really shine well on that medium to small side of the game spectrum, and then you move them into the large game segment like elk and moose and caribou and things, you've got to know what you're up to. You've got to know how your bullet technology works and what it's supposed to do and how to make it do that thing. And then to your point, you do need to be cognizant of your, you know, your max window of operation, because we're dealing with a cartridge that has less mass, less velocity, less energy. You have a much smaller margin of error that you can work with. Mm-hmm. And if we're shooting things like elk that are very large and robust animals, you know, that 650-yard cross canyon shot and all you've got is a quartering away, well, I mean, one, how good are you as a shooter? Two, can your bullet do it? Like, move the cartridge aside. Can the bullet make it to the vitals? Can it deploy? Can it deposit the energy needed and destroy the tissue needed? Can it get through to the other side to give us another hole for blood to come out and air to come in? That's why larger cartridges exist, because smaller ones might not necessarily be able to do it.
But with that said,
yeah,
at that point, the cartridge itself is interchangeable and the rifle can stay the same.
The bullet could be interchangeable.
The bullet could be interchangeable, but the rifle can stay the same, right?
Yeah.
So like if I have one rifle, I can hunt one bullet for whitetails and coyotes, and then another bullet for moose and elk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. All right.
You gotta be on top of what are the realistic limitations of that cartridge. Bullet aside too. So like I have a 6.5 Creedmoor. I have multiple 6.5 Creedmoors. That's a very endearing cartridge to me. It's a cartridge that I just love to shoot. I've gotten very dear friends of mine from a not even crawling stage to marathon running stage for hunting big game, for shooting long range with that cartridge, because it is so good at it. But you've got to respect its limitations. The inverse of that is, and I'll tell a quick story. My next door neighbor, one of my best friends in the whole wide world, he and I took very different paths in life. You know, I stayed with the hunting thing. He and I hunted growing up together. You know, he started a family, started a business, got very busy. And then once he had some pocket money, he said, "Hey, I want to start hunting big game and I want to chase elk and I want to chase mule deer." He doesn't have a rifle other than like an AR-15 because he and I did a little bit of competitive shooting together, and he's done some coyote hunting. And he says, what do I get? I'm going elk hunting. I drew a tag. And on one side of the coin, we have 300 Winchester Magnum, this ubiquitous big game cartridge. And on the other, we have 6.5 Creedmoor, this technically marginal cartridge for doing things like elk hunting, but one that he can afford to shoot. It won't kick his teeth in. He can get very competent with it very quickly with low impact on himself and low impact on his bank account. Do you start the race with the one you can barely hold on to and hope for the best? Or do you get really, really good with the one that you've just got to be very careful with? And I took a gamble and I said, I think you start with this one. And he went from having no idea how minute of angle or milliradian worked in like the turret manipulations to being able to chronograph his load data, populate a dope chart, hit a 600-yard target without trying, with routine frequency, to taking it on his first elk hunt and killing a cow elk. I think it was 356 yards. And he picked the right bullet for that job, and he folded that elk like a $5 tent because he had the confidence in his equipment from iteration and practice and iteration and practice. He had the right bullet. And he had the terminal package at that distance to do it. And he's done it again and again and again. 6.5 Creedmoor. Very lenient cartridge. Works great for coyotes. Works great for whitetail. Can work great for elk as long as you're cognizant of those limitations and you're bulleting correctly. Yeah. He has since bought a 300 Win Mag. He has remarked to me that, man, that thing kicks. I hate shooting it. I don't shoot it as good as I do my 6.5. Well, the one that you can shoot, and you can shoot well, is the best one to have.
Right.
So I'm generally not keen on telling folks, like, hey, go to the biggest you can go. Go to the biggest you can handle. And I'll even put an asterisk behind that and maybe one off that. And so it's still enjoyable to shoot and affordable to shoot.
Yeah. I mean, from what I'm picking up here, a lot of it has to do, obviously, budget plays a huge role, but what you're comfortable in and what you practice with a lot. Right?
Yep.
The more you practice, the better you are. So,
yep.
Okay. Talked about shotguns. Mm-hmm. We talked about rifles, right? Mm-hmm. These are two staples in the outdoorsman's gun cabinet.
Yes.
What's the next firearm now that we're looking at?
Well, the question is begged, AR or pistol? Without talking about BB guns or muzzleloaders, right? Mm-hmm. So I worked for an AR company for a long time. I've got a lot of experience in that space. You know, the stigma surrounding those weapon systems is alleviated quickly every day. And actually, you're a great example. So you're in Iowa. I can get you an AR-15, and with two pins that I push out of the side, I separate the upper and the lower. I can put a 22 long rifle upper on there. I can put a 450 Bushmaster upper on there. I can put a 223 upper on there. I can put a 6 arc upper on there, and I can give you a platform that you're functional with for anything that you want to do. You tell me you want to go hunt mule deer with your AR-15. Sure. Why not? Pop those pins out, take that off, put a 6 arc or a 6.5 Grendel upper on there. You're good to go. You want to hunt Iowa's firearm season? You can get an upper on there that will allow you to shoot a 450 Bushmaster. No sweat. No question about it. You want to shoot squirrels? 22LR. You want to plink in the backyard just for fun? 22LR. I mean,
okay. And for the uninitiated here, the Bushmaster, are we talking straight wall cartridges?
Yep, correct. Yep.
Okay, so that makes that gun usable for
about everything.
For youth seasons as well.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I want to focus on that a little bit because that would be a reason for me to buy said,
sure,
you know, AR, so I can get involvement with my kids for youth season and you know, some target shooting, squirrels, small game, things like that. What would be the best layout there then for a kid? And I'm talking anybody from 70 pounds. My son is 70 pounds to my daughter, to my wife, who's like 105.
Sure. So what's really cool about the platform is it's designed to inspire control. Because if you think about it from its military application, we needed to issue these to GIs ranging from 105 pounds to 255 pounds. the same platform needed to work with everybody across that scale, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got guys that are 6'5" and we've got guys that are 5'2". And we need one system that will work for all of them. And so if you look at a lot of the ARs that you can buy, and this isn't even talking about putting them together yourself, because you can do that too. One of the more novel things about it is, one, its grip, which is a pistol style grip. So different than our hunting rifles or our hunting shotguns for the most part. You have this grip that whether you have a little hand or whether you have an adult man hand, you can hold on to. And then two, the stock. It oftentimes can be fitted, or every time can be fitted, with a telescoping stock unless your state disallows that. And so if you've got a youngster who's under 5 foot and you want to set them up with a 350 Legend for hunting deer in Iowa, and we're going to be out of a ground blind or a box blind, and, you know, we're going to be shooting in weird positions and out of windows or out of ports, having the ability to slide that stock forward so that youngster with their small stature and small frame can control that gun, brilliant. Mm-hmm. The controls themselves, like the safety selector, they're thumb adjustable. So on either side, you can get an ambidextrous safety. So if you've got a right-handed or a left-handed kiddo, no sweat. They're generally very compact, or can be made very compact, or had compact. So that's not some gargantuan system that they're going to have to worry about, you know, how's my muzzle control? Am I banging it on the windows? That kind of thing. It really is a platform spectacularly conducive for success for exactly the scenario you described. You've got a gambit of shooters spanning different sizes, different weights, and you need a system that they can drive comfortably and confidently. The AR is one of the most marvelous things that has ever been introduced to the American hunting public, for those reasons alone. The calibers, that's just the bonus part, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you go out and you buy, brand X, Y, or Z, and you get it chambered in 223. Because that's the cartridge that they normally come in. You've got your coyotes covered, and you've got your center fire practice round covered. So you can buy 223 ammo for 40 cents a round. You buy an upper receiver from brand A, B, or C in 350 Legend. All you do is you just pop the upper off. It's two pins. Whoosh, comes off. Put the new one on. Click. And you're good to go. Now we can hunt deer. And again, pop that upper off, put a 22LR upper on there. Now you can shoot pop cans in the backyard. Low recoil, low noise, next to nothing for cost. Just the upper itself and the magazines. Really a spectacular solution. You can even get them in pistol calibers, 9mm, 40 Smith & Wesson, 45 ACP. So you can have a ton of fun with it. And you can bring somebody who's very new to this, like a youngster, for instance, and you can start them at that low impact, low noise, low recoil, 22LR, the controls and the familiarity are identical. Graduate them to a 223. Now they can play at 100, 200 yards and understand like what trajectory is and what muzzle blast is and how it doesn't actually hurt you. It just scares you, so you can overcome that. And then you can walk them into that 350 Legend or 450 Bushmaster for your Iowa firearms deer season. Mm-hmm. And just have a gas of a time. Without having to, like my dad did, start me off with a 30-06 at the age of 12 and say, good luck, son.
Kabow.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Really is a platform that is so scalable and so adept at getting, especially an inexperienced and new shooter, proficient quickly, mm-hmm. without the detriments of recoil or without the detriments of muzzle blast.
Right.
Yeah.
And all I heard there, you know, through the description that you were giving there, is options.
Yeah.
Right.
Tons
of options with that. And I look at, something like that and I go, man, that I can use it. My wife can use it. My kids can use it. And then you gave all the examples that we need. So that's my next purchase, to be honest with you.
Sure.
Is going to be something like that.
And, yep.
That might be a off the air conversation later on, or email. I'm like, okay, dude, I got the money. Point me in the right direction type deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when we think about an AR, there's also talk about the fun shooting side of things, as well as, do we have to have a different conversation with an AR? Like, if we're talking about home protection?
Not necessarily. So here again, a lot of social engineering behind what is a home defense AR and what is a hunting AR.
Yeah.
And let's look back at archery for a little bit. Do you shoot any 3D leagues?
No, I do not.
Have you ever?
Yes, I have.
You could use your hunting bow to shoot 3D.
Yep.
You could also be one of those nerds that has a competition bow, mm-hmm. right? So at the end of the day, the string comes back, the cams rotate, the arrow goes forward, we use some sort of sight.
Yeah.
That is not to say that you will lose that league if you shoot your hunting bow, or you will win that league if you shoot a competition bow. There are attributes to either that give you runway in the respective category that you're in. So like your hunting bow is going to probably be lighter, more compact, doesn't have a 3 foot long stabilizer on it. You know, and that's going to be more conducive for success in hunting. And your competition bow is going to be more stable, heavier, you know, longer axle to axle, more forgiving for your competitive circle. But you could blend the lines, right? With your hunting bow. And I feel the same way with the conversation surrounding a home defense firearm. Number one, the one in hand is better than the one not in hand. Mm-hmm. So I suppose if all I had was my 54 caliber Hawken muzzleloader for a home defense scenario, well, I've got one really good shot. do I prefer that to a Glock 21 with a weapon light on it? I do not. I prefer the Glock 21 with a weapon light on it. But you can blend those lines. And I think with an AR, you know, you could dress it up to be optimized for the home defense thing. So you put like a flashlight on it, or you put like a suppressor on it so it doesn't rattle your cage when you're in your living room. But then again, you could also use a 16-inch AR to call coyotes or hunt deer, and it's the same gun at the end of the day, right? If there's not some accoutrement or some piece of equipment hung on it that deems it more optimal for home defense, subjective.
Yeah, I gotcha. It's one of those, it's all on how you use it, right? Because
correct.
A 12-gauge slug to a home intruder would have some stopping power as well.
It would. It could also make a new window in your house. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so that's another thing. And I think this is where we have this conversation with pistols next.
Yep.
Right? Okay. So we talked about the AR platform. I mean, it is... There's a million different things you can do with it, mm-hmm. and outdoors, home. It almost seems to me like it's another one-stop shop type of deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing that we talk about is pistols, mm-hmm. right? And are pistols for the outdoorsman more of that fun shooting thing, or is there actual usage from a pistol that we can have when we're out chasing game?
Sure. So I think two categories. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll give you three. I know Mark Boardman, my podcast co-host here at Vortex, or I should say I'm his sometimes co-host. He's the host. Mark has pistols. Mm-hmm. He uses them for two things, primarily recreation. Mm-hmm. So he enjoys shooting handguns because they're fun. The secondary in the outdoor space is like bear protection. So it's not a gun that he's out actively hunting with, although he could. It's going to be, he's wearing it on his bino harness or on his pack or on his hip when he's in big bear country, as an opportunity to not get eaten by Ursus horribilis. So you could also then hunt with one, right? So I've got a Magnum Research BFR chambered in 44 Magnum. That is my hunting revolver, and it's geared as such. It's a very heavy, large, you know, revolver. It's got an optic on it. It would be dreadful to carry it as bear protection. It is also not fun to shoot for fun. If I load it down and I, you know, give it these little powder puff loads, yeah, it's a hoot to shoot. But it's not one that, like, if I go to the range and I want to go shoot steel targets as fast as I can shoot steel targets, and I want to tip over dueling trees and plate racks, that's not what I'm bringing. It's costly and it hurts. So that one is solely for chasing deer or pronghorn or hogs, whatever I might be into. And it's set up as such. Mm-hmm. With like Mark's example, where he's got, say, a Glock 19 He can use that pistol, as I mentioned earlier, for recreation. If he wants to go down to Vortex Edge, our range, and he wants to go do speed drills with Chris and Justin and the guys, he's perfectly set up for it. It's an exact option that a person would want to get into. Conversely, he clicks that into his holster on his pack, and he goes to Alaska, and he's chasing Sitka blacktails on Kodiak. He's covered down for bears as well. It plays well. So I think if you're shopping for a pistol as an outdoors person, identify what you're after. Do you want to hunt deer with a pistol, or do you want to hunt bears with a pistol, or do you want to hunt pigs with a pistol? There's a better choice for that than, say, the pistol that I would wear every day for personal protection. Mm-hmm. You know, it's probably going to be a revolver, or it's going to be like a 10 millimeter semi-automatic handgun. So it's got adequate stopping power to take a big game animal cleanly and effectively. And then if you're the person who's like, nope, I want a bear defense gun, mm-hmm. You could certainly go with a revolver. There's a lot of compelling reasons to. These days, with auto pistols, as great as they are, and whether that's a SIG or a Glock or a Heckler & Koch or a Smith & Wesson, you can get it in a cartridge like 9, 10, or 45, or 40. And with the right loading, loaded for bear. Mm-hmm. You can then take that same pistol, head to the range, and have a lot of fun with it, especially in like 9 and 45. These are two very affordable cartridges that don't beat the tar out of you, and you can have a lot of fun. And then if they live in your nightstand for home defense, better yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's because, you know, I personally don't see myself shooting any type of animal with a revolver or a, sure, a handgun anytime soon.
Yep.
So I would be more for that probably bear protection / yep, home defense type,
yep,
type gun. And is there a handgun that you would look at for that specific scenario?
Sure. I'm unabashedly a Glock fanboy.
Okay.
I've been a Glock guy since forever. I've always loved their utility. They are ugly. That is true. Although beauty is in the eye of the beholder, they're a gun that for me just works.
Yeah.
I've carried them for, how old am I now, Dan?
I don't know.
I've carried them for 15 years. I have shot them competitively for 10. I've been a Glock certified armor since I think 2007. So I've had a lot of time with that system. Yeah. And I've come to trust it, and I can get a Glock in 22 long rifle. They're model 44. Mm-hmm. I can get a Glock in 10 millimeter. They're model 40, and everything in between. I won't tell you how many I have, but they're kind of like Pokemon. You got to catch them all. So
like, I gotta say something.
Yeah.
There's a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger where I think it's Commando.
Yeah.
Where his daughter gets taken from him.
Yep.
And now he has to go get her back.
Yep.
But before he takes this helicopter to this island, yep, he stops at a gun store, and he takes, like, there's rocket launchers, there's all these,
oh, yeah,
guns and stuff. I just imagine coming to your house and seeing just guns on your coffee table, like on the wall, in your refrigerator, like craziness.
Are you telling me you don't have a fridge gun?
I don't have a fridge gun. I need a fridge gun.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And a freezer gun. So you got to have one underneath the peas,
yep,
yep, and one behind the ketchup.
Yep. Prepared for anything.
The truth of the matter is I've been in the space for long enough to have heard the sad stories from people who do have stuff just strewn about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, home invasions are a thing. Everything I have is behind steel, concrete, yeah, lock and key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. But yeah, there's a little part of me that wishes I would come to your house sometime and just see. It's not even a house. It's like a vault with a couch and a TV in it.
I wish. Vault doors are expensive. I've thought about that. If I ever get to the point in my life where I can build my own home, yeah, I will promise you there will be a vault.
A vault.
That is, yeah, that is a thing that I will do.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. So muzzleloader. I'm going to skip this one for right now, because a muzzleloader to me is it's very niche,
yep,
per se. Like for me, it would only be used for, it would be big game, And then there's a lot of adjustments that you can do to it, like combinations. I know that the muzzleloader that I have, you know, has a scope on it. You could scope it out however the guy, you know, the guy wants to, along with depending on what animal you're shooting, depends on how many tabs you're putting in it. For me, I use the, what's the word I'm looking for?
Pellets.
Pellets. How many pellets, you know, who's shooting it. You can cut off the pellets to make it, you know, easier for a kid to shoot, things like that. Okay. Anything else real quick you would want to mention about a muzzleloader?
They're so much better than they are now, or they are so much better now than they were. When I got into that, I started muzzleloading about 05. Okay. And what was available then and what is available now is, I mean, it's not the same as like, oh, it's like we went from flintlock to modern inline. It's not that dramatic, but they're a lot of fun. If you're a serious big game hunter, they afford you opportunities just like your archery equipment would. You know, you can start hunting earlier, you can hunt later with them. And then, you know, there are states that I apply for solely with a muzzleloader.
Yeah.
So that I get the opportunity to hunt them, because I'll be old and die before I end up with a tag in my hand for the rifle hunt. So, you know, they're an interesting way to afford yourself opportunity that you wouldn't maybe otherwise get if you're not a crazy archer, or if you don't have the time or the resources to pull a rifle tag.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
The last gun that I want to talk about is that next step in a gun collection. I mean, I got my shotguns, I got my rifles, I got my home defense, I got my AR. The next gun that would be just for fun, or maybe to say I actually now have a quote unquote collection, meaning it maybe has some sort of historical, you know, historical or personal sentiment. Like what does that next gun look like?
Everybody's going to be different on this one. And this is somewhat what I alluded to very early on in this production. When I started collecting, it was chaos. I was collecting because I thought something was cool, because I saw it in a movie, or I knew that, you know, like with military firearms, I knew that this was a staple of X, Y, or Z's military. And then I started collecting because I was looking for some level of prestige or something. My hunting partner, for instance, collects old Winchesters. I didn't have a Winchester budget, but I did have a Remington budget. And so I collected early Remington 700s. And interestingly, all in 30-06, which was odd. These days, I'm now collecting. I've owned about every new gun that I've kind of ever wanted. And I make that statement a bit tongue in cheek, because my fascinations get piqued every single day by new things. But I'm now looking at pieces that are more investment level. So, you know, I want my money to be worth something someday. And so I'm not spending it on, you know, a $500 Remington 700. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but once you've owned eight, you've owned them all. And now I'm looking for pieces that are, they have some sort of self-assigned level of prestige for me. I don't own anything that I wouldn't hunt or I wouldn't shoot, because I think it's interesting to take neat things out and do with them what they were intended to do. Right. So, you know, that's the very personal part about it. That's very difficult to say, well, this is where you need to put your money, because it depends. I got into Winchester lever guns a little bit, a few years ago, about 2016. And that kind of sparked some very interesting curiosities that led me into hunting with old guns. You know, guns that were either patented in the 1880s, not necessarily examples of guns that were built in the 1880s, or not examples, but actual guns that were built in the 1880s, but just that older style of firearm. I started hunting with a Winchester 1885 and 4570. I actually went three seasons working for Vortex Optics, not running a single rifle scope. I was just shooting a peep sighted 4570. I killed a mule deer, pronghorn, and whitetail with it. I've got a bison, an elk, and a bear to collect with it yet. That led me into an 1895 pattern lever gun chambered in 405, which led me into a variant of the Winchester Model 94 called the Model 64, which was a more deluxe version. I'm still pursuant of a Winchester 1892 to use for hunting. And that has led me astray on some other just older historical firearms that were, you know, at the time of their inception, whether it was in the teens, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, represented the best that a sports person could buy. That to me represent, you know, kind of a throwback to the way things used to be, but also a new challenge, right? So this past year, I hunted with a 1952 vintage Winchester Model 70 and 270 that I put a period correct Redfield on. Figure the scope was built in probably the mid 60s, and I put it in a set of rings that were built in the late 50s. And I wanted, just like a car collector would have a certain car, and everything had to be correct. There couldn't be any modern amenity
so,
in it.
So real authenticity.
Yep.
In it. Yep. Okay.
Yep. Or, you know, I'm getting more into bespoke shotguns and bespoke rifles, you know, stuff, European built things that are fancy if only to be that way. And it gives me like a feel here when I hunt with them. And it is just totally personal, you know, somebody who says, oh, that collection is invalid because all it is just old military firearms. Well, holy smokes. I mean, you think about the writing of history of the modern world. It was written with those slung over the shoulders of the men with the pens. Mm-hmm. So those are significant collector's items, right? Mm-hmm. And really, when it comes to that, when you start thinking about, okay, I want to take my collection from functional to a collection that now supersedes function. We're not collecting because we have a need for something. We have a collection because we have a want for something. That's really up to you. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that, you know, think about your finances. This is something I tell friends of mine who are getting into it or colleagues of mine. Think about your finances and it's cool to have, but you should think about, you know, if all of a sudden someday comes where you need money for something, an operation, a vehicle, a mortgage payment, whatever, collect with intent so that that collection valuates over time. It doesn't stagnate and it certainly doesn't devaluate, but it valuates over time. And that's been something that I've been trying to do consciously for the better part of a decade now so that I'm not just covered in stuff, but what that looks like to the individual is very difficult to say, you know, because people get fascinated by things that for them are crazy fascinating, for the next guy are mundane. So you've got to, there'll be a little self audit there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
All right. So money is not an option. Sure. Brian Muckenhurn. Mm-hmm. You have one gun that you don't currently have in your collection, and you don't have there. You can write as many zeros out for it as you want. Do you know what gun you would buy right now if you had the money to add to your collection?
Yeah.
What is it?
1903 Mannlicher Schoenauer carbine and 6.5x54 Mannlicher.
Wow, I don't know what any of that means.
It's not even that expensive. It's just hard to get.
Yeah, and what about that gun makes it worth you putting your time and energy and money to try to get it?
So when I was a lad, I was reading an author, Peter Hathaway Capstick, and he wrote about global hunters, but really a lot of them in Africa. And one of the very famous ivory hunters at the time that ivory hunting was still a thing was a gentleman by the name of William Bell, or WMD Bell, as he was often written. One of his premier selections for killing elephants was a 1903 Mannlicher chambered in 6.5x54 Mannlicher, which is an extraordinarily anemic cartridge. Bell had gotten so proficient at killing elephants that he realized he didn't need this giant rifle to do it. My initial fascination came from, one, the guy was killing elephants for profit, which is something is just unheard of nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. You know, most people think that you can't hunt elephants and that they're endangered beyond in peril, and there's only 18 of them left. But at a time, there was a serious trade in ivory. And there was a profession around this, and Bell was himself a bit of an outlaw that ended up in Africa and had hunted countries that aren't countries anymore, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And when I finally found an example of that rifle, it was in a magazine, I think it was Field and Stream. There was just like a little hit piece on it. And I looked at the gun. I mean, it's tiny. It's a 19 and a half inch barreled carbine. It's a very short, svelte little piece of equipment. It was Austrian built right at the turn of the century. So 1903, that's when that rifle came into existence. And they didn't build them for very long. They stopped building them in the late 30s. And so there's only a few thousand examples on the entire planet that have survived.
Yeah.
I try to be aware of as many of them as I can that are being publicly sold now.
Yeah.
And there's a few out there. Most of them have been molested a little bit, and they're not right. I'm looking for one that's right.
That's
and
perfect.
I have been looking for one that's right since 2007. That was the last time I touched one, and that was the first time I touched one, and I have not found one since.
So when you go, like, is it just a money thing at this point? Like, you know what you want? You're just waiting to pull the trigger on the right one.
It's finding the right one.
Yep.
And most of them have been tattooed or re-blued or goofed with in a manner that is, it's not reconcilable to me. Yeah. So finding one that is in the condition that I want it, mm-hmm. Is tough.
Yeah.
So I'm aware of about 7 of them right now.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy, dude. All right. Yeah. Well, good luck on your journey. I hope someday you can set that in your house. Now the question is, you get that.
Yeah.
Does Ryan Muckenhorn try to go out and shoot an elephant with that gun?
So as cool as that would be, I am aware of no country that will allow that for pachyderms. Most of them have a minimum of 375 H&H. So I don't think that's a thing. I would hunt the tar out of it though. And I'll tell you, I think it would make a fine mule deer pronghorn whitetail round.
And so you're not, this is something where it has a value to you, not from the resale in like investment side, but to how kick-ass would it be to hunt with that gun in North America, chasing the game that you love to chase?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, and they don't cost no money. I mean, they're still an expensive gun, but relative to what you can spend on a gun. I mean, if you wanted to spend $350,000 on a Holland & Holland Royale Deluxe in 12 or 20 or 16 or 20 acage, you can. You can do it right now. You can call Holland's and they'll write you an order and you can spend almost $500,000 like that. It's not even near that. I mean, you can probably pick up a stellar example of one of these things for $3,000 if you can find it. And for me, the romance is one, the history of the rifle. Two, the mechanism is flawless. I mean, they're about as cool as you can get from a mechanical system. And they're beautiful. They embody everything that I would want in a sporting rifle.
Yeah.
Just can't touch them.
There you go. Well, dude, I hope someday your dream comes true with that.
I look every day.
Dude, we had a great conversation today, Ryan. I really appreciate you coming on and being the expert today and talking to me about something. Like, I don't know. This conversation really was for the listener of this podcast because I truly do not know anything about guns. I am interested in them, and I'm going to become more interested in them as I get older and as my kids become more involved. And I thought you're the perfect person to talk to. So as always, Ryan, man, I really appreciate your time today.
It is my pleasure, and thank you all for tuning in.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.